And welcome everyone to another episode of All Things Trek. I'm Oren.
I am Grace.
David Jich. Wait, no. I'm David.
No Klingon on the podcast, David. God damn it.
Well, hey, let's try and keep ourselves culturally open here.
We did have an episode about how cool Cardassians were last week, so maybe I should try to be more accepting of other cultures and their languages, even if I can't understand them. I just worry that David is saying mean things about me. It's like, you know, I don't know what he's saying. It could be like, you know, when he's making those guttural sounds in his throat, it could just be like, yeah, that Oren. God, what a terrible
Check
podcast host.
Check your human
host.
Privilege, Oren.
That's a fair point. So before we do any main topics for today, I have two things that I want to get to. The first is a post made by Jara Hodge over on her blog, the Trekkie Feminist, which is a quote from an interview with Denise Crosby that they did in Starlog magazine back in 1995. And I'm just going to read it because it's interesting. I want to get your guys' takes on it. "I remember a scene I had to do in my audition, which really showed you what the character could have been, what I thought Tasha was going to be. It was an extraordinary scene, and it's a shame it never appeared in any of our shows. I really don't know why it didn't. It was a scene in which Tasha had real problems on the ship. She idolized Captain Picard. He represented a father figure to her. He embodied all the perfect patriarchal power and together male things that she never had in life. Because she endowed him with such power, she had problems dealing with him. He scared her, and she felt very insecure around him, even though she deserved to be in her position. She sent to Troy, who's really acting as shipboard shrink in this scene, which I suppose is her job. They try to get to what Tasha's problem was about. Troy, out of the blue, asks Tasha, when was the last time you had sex? Tasha says, what? And Troy asks it again. Tasha asks how that applies to the problem. Troy says, no, 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 you've got to have some time off for yourself. Basically, Troy told Tasha, go and get laid for a few days, then come back and tell me how you feel. It was an extraordinary scene Marina and I used to talk about all the time. Where the hell was that scene? Why didn't we ever get to do it? It allowed the two of us to interact, which we rarely did in my 20-something shows. Marina and I had never had more than a few lines to say to each other. That would have been a very insightful scene." So, that I'm not sure how I feel about that exactly. I'd be interested to get your guys' take on it.
Well, I'm going to agree with what Denise Crosby had to say, that for good or for bad, it would have at least been interesting to see. We really got the bare minimum of interaction between most of the characters in that first season, at least with Troy and Tasha. And so that would have been really interesting to see how the two of them would interact as characters more so than what we got to see. It would have just been something that the show could have benefited from.
Fair enough. I can't help but feel like it would have been kind of a sort of trivializing a very real problem that Tasha has, because, like, you know, she is supposed to be from this really terrible background on this planet that had no, you know, where everything was awful. And
yeah, but trivializing it or no, at least we would have gotten an acknowledgement that she had these problems and that this was an issue for her.
Sort of. I mean, I don't know. I feel like it would have been like saying, responding to this real problem that Tasha has of having a hard time dealing with a male authority figure by saying you need to go have sex. Just it's like it. It seems like, I mean, granted, I can see Troy doing that because Troy is the worst counselor in the universe. But it just seems like a really
counselor feel good. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's not like I can never see a counselor saying you should go have sex, but that would have to be like if your problem was related to sex somehow, and it doesn't seem like her problem is. So I don't know. It's, I mean, I can see why Denise Crosby wanted that scene, because she hardly gets anything in the first season. So I could see why that was something that she wanted to do, but I feel like it was probably a good idea not to have it.
Well, then her response could be, computer, locate Commander Data, but, it's kind of, I don't know, that, I think if it would depend on how the scene would be played, you know, obviously if it was a fleshed out scene, because if it's just flippant, like, oh, just go get laid, you know, that would almost, or, you know, whatever, like, oh, just go get drunk, whatever, that kind of diminishes the problem that she's going through. It kind of makes Troy look in a weird light. But it kind of, on one hand, you know, there's times where people are just so tense and stressed and, you know, pent up energy. Maybe they're, you know, on one hand, it's like, you know, go have a release, go relax, go, you know, something. But then the other thing that my mind thought of when I heard that was, they hardly ever really addressed sex in general except in certain cases where I don't know if they handled it well or not. But I remember, now remind me if you remember where I saw this, which is kind of odd to say, but I just remember recently seeing that, I think it might have been on Twitter where somebody was posting like trivia about Star Trek, but that in the early scripts, in the early writer's Bible type thing, it was supposed to be that Troy and Riker, obviously had the past of, the relationship, and then they both mutually uncoupled or whatever the thing is, the way you call it now. But
that does sound like a Betazoid thing, doesn't it?
Even then, when we see them on the show, that they were supposed to be still casual sex partners. Like, they would just have casual sex with each other. And that they would be supportive and accepting that they're going to, each of them would go off and have other partners, and so not that they would be like exclusive, but they would just still have casual sex. And I thought that's kind of weird or interesting, but in a way that plus this scene here, it kind of makes me think the people are supposed to be more enlightened, more evolved, more advanced. But they obviously are in a way still as repressed or, weird with sex as some people are today. And the only time I ever really saw anything that might give a hint about they've advanced their views of sex and the cultural, ideas about it was in The Perfect Mate, when Kamala is saying I've been, trained and educated in all the kinds of stuff, like science, Shakespeare, sex. And she just threw that out there. Like it was ooh, that's weird. Or that's, sensationalized or anything. It was just so then the other thing I thought is if it was going to be more like not just, go to 10 forward, find somebody and go get laid, but like almost treating it like a meditation or the Kama Sutra or tantric type of thing where using sex as a way to release energies in the body and do different. So I don't know. I think if it was handled right, it could be a decent scene and it would be interesting and not just played for laughs or, but I don't know, that's definitely an interesting and for an audition, like that's the way to introduce people or I don't know. That's just kind of trippy.
Yeah. Go ahead, Grace.
Sorry. For me, TNG always had this weird kind of sex phobia thing going for it, like where sex was the thing they would occasionally talk about and more often than not turn into a, sex thing and not actually take it seriously. Like, for example, the Lieutenant Yar and Data thing just being like, they had sex, they're not going to talk about it. And now Data's kind of following her like a lovesick puppy, but they're never actually going to address it. What's up with that kind of thing? It felt like they had a bunch of things in place that would have actually benefited from them just straight up saying, okay, this is how we view sex in the future. This is how our characters are going to talk about it. But they were just skirting around the issue and around the topic to a degree that made it kind of irrelevant.
Yeah, I've said this before, but Star Trek's attitude to sex has always struck me as being analogous with a 13-year-old who's just figured out his calculator can spell boobs. it's there, but it's more often than not very immature. We said sex. You guys couldn't see, but I covered my mouth when I said tee-hee-hee.
But of course.
So, David, and you brought up the whole issue of supposedly, according to the writer's Bible, Troy and Riker having, being casual sex partners. And that would have been really interesting because that's very rare on television. And when they do show it, it's usually like a cautionary tale. It's like, don't have casual sex. It will lead to problems.
Or again, sensationalized for the sake of, casual sex.
Yeah. So there's, but like, it's sort of that part of their character is kind of like how in the original show Bible, there were supposed to be whales on the Enterprise. Like, it's in there, but it never comes up in the show, really. Like, the closest that they ever had to that was in that one episode, I forget which one, where Troy and Riker are kind of randomly on a romantic picnic. And that scene sticks out because never at any other point in the series do they do anything like that. And it was just like, suddenly they're on a romantic picnic. What's going on with that?
I kind of like to think that's just what Troy does for fun on the weekend. She's like, hey, let's do a picnic! Like, with anyone who's free. Beverly, let's have a picnic. It'll be cool.
There's a new chocolate I want to try.
We can frolic through the tall grass.
I also feel like, especially with Yar's background of being someone who, at least, if not her, if she personally was not raped, because they never said that specifically, but she grew up on a planet where that was a really serious problem. It sounds, I feel like prescribing sex to deal with a stressful situation would not be good. Like, I'm all about not, you know, shaming sex and not treating it like it's some weird alien thing that nobody else ever does. But at the same time, it is a very personal thing. It's, you know, it's not like going to the gym to work out or watching a TV show to relax, right? It's much more involved than that, or at least it should be. And so I don't know. Like, the scene is intriguing, but I just, from the way that they did TNG, I can imagine it being really bad.
Yeah.
All right. So the other thing, we have an email from Data Logan, but looking at it, it's quite long. I think I'm going to save it for next week because I want to read through it and decide like which parts of it I actually want to read out loud, because there's some good stuff in it. But if we read it out loud, I'd probably be here most of the day. So we will get to that next week.
Rightio, then.
Yes. So for now, we will go to the main topic, which was your idea, Grace. So you want to introduce us to it?
Yes, it was. In continuing with our topic of motherhood and the role of mothers in Star Trek that we discussed recently, I thought we'd progress on to talking about child characters and how children are treated in Star Trek, both as characters and as individuals, and as just part of the Star Trek universe. So hang on a second here.
And this is a sort of a continuation of a topic we did with Jera a few weeks back when Grace wasn't here. We talked about child characters, but this was specifically, Grace, I remember you saying you wanted to look at how they are presented as being independent characters as opposed to just extensions of their parents.
Right, which means that we need to start this discussion by first establishing what makes for a good child character. I think we've established that they need to be at least well-rounded as a character and do more than just act as an extension of the character of the adult in their life or their parents.
I'm going to go ahead and present Exhibit A, Arya Stark. And if all child characters were Arya Stark, then we could, you know, the world would be a better place.
Compared to, like, the kids from Everybody Loves Raymond, where they're just there and they're, like, they're there to be a problem and they're there to be a hurdle for the more important adult characters to have. And yet we never actually see them, and they don't have actual personalities. They're just there as the idea of being children, but not actually there.
Yeah, and you see that on a lot of shows, right?
Yeah, and it annoys me.
That's fair. Now, I guess the question about what makes a good child character, I guess the question would be, is that different than what makes a good adult character, right? Because, you know, you want an adult character, or any character, really, you want them to act like a real person. If they're going to be a good character, you want them to be, you know, rounded, and you want to be able to empathize with them, or if not empathize with them, at least be interested in what they're doing.
Right, but again, we've established that already when you're talking about a child character, from the get-go, they're going to be approached differently in how they are related to the adults in the story, and which is more important to talk about, what's happening to the adult, what's happening to the child, and how much of what's happening to the child actually matters, versus how much what happens to an adult character matters.
And if it's handled right, and it's, you know, written well, and not just, you know, like the quote-unquote four kids, but just written as a story for everybody and not done for laughs and whatever, like a sitcom. But if it's handled well, in a way, I think a child character, you know, maybe not a toddler, like, you know, if we're going too, so young, but a child or a teen-type character could almost be more interesting than some of the adult characters because they're figuring out life, they're figuring out who they are, they're going through changes of, you know, physicality and just psychological. And so, and then there's the whole idea about almost being the fish out of water of, like, here's the adult world, all the adults run everything, there's the laws and the economy and everything. And in a way, children are kind of removed from that. But then there's that point where children are realizing, I can't just have every toy I want, or, you know, whatever, you know, they're having to realize, oh, there's stuff in the world that I'm going to have to deal with and figure out. So sometimes I think that could be an interesting situation to explore, especially, like, you know, as the person, as the child, teen, is figuring out what kind of person do they want to be, making mistakes, you know, making, doing something and then regretting it and having to right a wrong they did, versus just, you know, adults just, you know, doing a job or being, you know, a function of, you know, I'm a cop or something.
Right, versus that child just having the function of, I'm a kid, I'm here to make your life difficult. So I think that that kind of has established what we're looking for in a good, well-rounded child character. Thank you, David.
Now, here's a thought, here's just a question. When you're looking at a child character, is it important for them to be written, like, as a child, or do you, or like, are you concerned about them being written too much like a miniature adult? Because that's something that I've had a problem with, not so much in Star Trek, because that's not really an issue, but in, like, in other media, like, you know, I mentioned Game of Thrones earlier, so I'm going to go ahead and use that example.
Even though
Sansa Stark is probably the most annoying of the Stark children, I have a special place for her in my heart, because she's the only one that seems to act like a child, whereas the other characters all act like adults in small bodies to me. Where they're all very good at knowing what's going on and, like, being, like, knowing when someone is trying to trick them, when in my experience, like, I don't know, it feels like children are more trusting of people they've been told they should trust, whereas the other Stark children are like, we know the Lannisters are and the nobles who are aligned with them are bad because we are, you know, analyzing it in the way an adult would, whereas Sansa is kind of like, no, that's, you know, I was told they're good, so they're good, I'll trust them. Like, I don't know, does that strike you as an issue with child characters?
Totally, yeah. And maybe it would be less of an issue if we had, like, a wider range and variety rather than just they're going to approach this as a kid as completely like a child would, or they're going to approach it completely like a miniature adult would. Maybe if we were able to, in media, explore the middle ground a little more, it'd be less jarring when that happens, when we have the juxtaposition of the two.
Well, and again, I think it depends on how it's handled and how it's written, because if it was just all one way, like all the kids are just written as, like, you know, little children, and then all the children are written as just, you know, adults, and they're, like, using big words that they wouldn't really use. I think, you know, it would be interesting almost to have the mixture in the actual, whether it's a TV show or a movie, a book or whatever, because even in, like, in my experience, I'm sure, you know, for everybody, there is different levels of maturity, even
totally.
as a, you know, you could pick out, you know, let's say just randomly picking numbers and age, like, you know, pick 10, 12-year-olds. They're not all going to have the same, you know, education level. They're not going to have the same sense of humor. They're not going to have the same maturity level. And it would be interesting to see, I've actually seen it where a kid would be like, you know, 12, 10, and they're almost more childlike than somebody who would be 8 or 7. And I think that's partly just that individual, like, how do they process, you know, the world, their thoughts and whatever, but also how they're brought up. Because one thing I like to think, I not like to, but one thing I often think about in when seeing portrayals of children on, you know, sitcoms, TV shows, dramas, all that, is like, the cultural differences, but also the time, like, you know, what era is it from? Because a lot of times in the modern world, in our current day, some people want to focus on, you know, let them be a child, you know, let childhood last longer. And when they're saying that, they're basically saying, let them be playful, you know, enjoy toys, not have to worry about the world in a way. But
let them be blissfully ignorant, kind of.
Right, because if you go back and look, and this even has a Star Trek, you know, in a way, a connection of, remember when Janeway would go to the holodeck and do her, you know, Victorian-type style holodeck plays, those children were not, you know, just playful, blissfully ignorant, and even in our real world, there's times where a young child would have to learn two languages and be called Master, you know, Master Wayne or whatever, and wear adult type clothes, but they're, you know, sized down. They're not going to be playing with, you know, little building blocks and, you know, going watching Yo Gabba Gabba or whatever. So in a way, it's cultural. But then how do the parents, you know, raise that child to where you could have almost a miniature adult or close to that, and then the next kid right next to him is going like, you know, yabba dabba doo or something. So it, I think it's how they're portrayed could relate to how could, you know, inform how are they raised, and then if you're seeing differences like that. But if they're all one way, like if they're all just written like miniature adults, I think that's a, would be a failing of the
or
the
like
writer.
Miniature roadblocks for the characters just to right. be the to serve the purpose of being the child.
Well, that would be the worst of it when, you know, when you could tell that they're basically just like, it could be an animal, it could be, you know, they're just a device, not given a personality and layers of it. But so yeah, I do look at that and notice it like, oh, you know, they're treating this all in this whatever episode or TV movie, whatever, like, oh, they're writing kids that way. And, you know, sometimes it's disappointing.
And with that in mind, let's get started with one of the first child characters we wanted to talk about. Let's start by going with the problem of Molly O'Brien.
Well, Molly O'Brien...
Good golly.
I mean, I actually feel pretty neutral on Molly O'Brien, because on the one hand, she's not really a character, but on the other hand, I never felt like she was intended to be, right?
Like, right. Again, she just is there to serve the placeholder kind of as the child.
Yeah.
Well, especially because she's so young. I mean, it's like, you know, not a baby, but not like a little Alexander or somebody. It's like she's really young.
No, we kind of see her around the age when we first see Alexander on TNG. But we don't really get any actual, like, story for her the way we do with Alexander, except for the one episode where she's turned into an adult.
Well, into a teenager anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so with Molly, I feel like Molly's character... Like, well, Molly's character isn't really. There isn't really one. And unlike, say, Alexander, I'd say that's okay with Molly because she doesn't get... They don't use a whole lot of screen time with her. You know, she is an extension of her... She presents an occasional point of conflict for O'Brien and Keiko, right? And,
right, she isn't even an extension of their characters. She's an extension of the problems with their relationship.
Right. And to a certain extent, I think that's okay. Like, I don't think that every single child in... If the show is about a parent, I don't think that that means that every child has to be a big character. Because I,
right,
if you do that... Sorry, go ahead.
And definitely considering the main plot of DS9, she's definitely, like, a tertiary priority. There's a war, there's politics going on, so she doesn't need to be someone who we're exploring fully. She's just kind of there. And that's the purpose she serves, and it works for the sake of the show.
Yeah, which and again, because it's like, since you tend to notice that a lot of characters in TV shows are always single with no children, because, you know, and for some, that's just a thing, and it doesn't really represent humans, right? You know, if you watch TV shows, you would think every person on Earth is an attractive 20-something. Or their occasional grizzled mentor. So, you know, I appreciate just having a married character in Chief O'Brien. Now, the way that they actually do handle his marriage when they do get into it is really stupid, but we'll save that for another day.
Yeah, the execution.
But with Molly, I thought they handled Molly pretty well. Like, Molly is on screen, and when she's on screen, you know, she does, you know, she is a kid and she has to go to school. But I thought it was okay that there weren't plots centered around her, or that we didn't really learn that much about her, except in, of course, the one episode where she goes through a time vortex, which is an episode.
I wouldn't really say it was centered around her, but I thought she played into, like, she was a factor in that if wishes, well, if that's the right one, with the Rumpelstiltskin episode, like, in,
oh,
it was
gosh,
kind of,
right.
It was, you know, because of her that this whole thing happened. And the way I looked at Molly was
I don't think it was because of her. I think she was just the first case where it happened.
Well, it was because Miles was reading that Rumpelstiltskin story to her, and then that set off the whole chain of events in a way. So, like, that's why I was thinking it wasn't centered around her, but, like, she was a contributing factor, a player in that. But I never thought, like, oh, that was, they wrote her bad, you know, because it's, in a way, she's just being the kid. But I looked at
right,
it.
Right, again, she served her character's purpose.
And I looked at it like, okay, we had O'Brien. He started on the Enterprise, And then he comes to DS9, and the whole premise of, you know, the big galaxy class on TNG, and we see it in other people, but like the idea that Starfleet officers have families now, like they could bring their families because we got the, you know, the big luxury liner, you know, hotel in space almost looking Enterprise compared to, you know, Kirk's Enterprise where there was no families and civilians. Like, but in a way on TNG, other than Alexander, which is like handled badly, we never got to see a main character having a family. It was always like, you know, some other guest star actor or some, you know, just a generic, you know, Starfleet officer that is having kid, you know, the school or whatever. Whereas with when Miles goes to DS9, I saw the whole function of Molly as like showing that like now it's not a starship that's just flying around getting into, you know, anomalies and dangers. Now they're at a space station, and it was to show that now here's a character with a family. And I don't think that idea would be as impactful or as demonstrated if Miles was just married, because then it would be like, okay, he's got a wife. But having Molly there, and then later when they have the son, that was to me the idea that like this is fam, like they're rooted, they're more stable location wise they're more stable of like, you know, routine or whatever. So now here's an example of, you know, an officer with a family. And then, you know, we don't really get that. And especially because we get Sisko, who has the son. So there's another example of like, you know, family oriented. And I don't mean like family, like family values. I just mean,
yeah,
you know, they have families now. And so that's a concern. It's something that, you know, they have to go home and, you know, and go to school and everything a little bit more than what we ever got on TNG.
Right, but moving along, you mentioned Alexander, and now we have to ask, how does Alexander serve that purpose?
Well, I was going to say, Alexander is kind of the reverse of this equation, because so Molly works because she's just, you know, she's there, she's a child, she, you know, Miles has to take care of her sometimes, and, you know, she's part of his life, but she isn't hugely influential on the main story. Because and she
aside from when Chief O'Brien's love life is the problem.
Yeah, although that's more of a Keiko problem than a Molly problem, or just a marriage issue, I should say, because it's, you know, I don't want it to sound like I'm just hating on the wife character. It's just that they didn't write that marriage very well. But
nope.
So, but with Alexander, I mean, we've talked about this before, is that he uses a lot of screen time for a character that basically doesn't do anything. Like, you know, if Alexander was just Worf had a kid and he was just around, then sure, that would be fine. I think that would probably be better than what we had. But with Alexander, it's just kind of like, yeah, he's a lot around, but where is he? Is he going, other than showing us that Worf is a terrible father, and B isn't willing to put in the effort to be a good father?
Again, this is kind of an example of when a child character is just kind of an extension of the problems of the adult character in their life.
I like this note we got in the chat room. Alexander's purpose is to be Worf's backup spine.
That sounds about right. Yeah. Like they kept him around in case Worf needed an extra kidney or something.
Yeah, because, I mean, really, over the course of the series, I never got much of a feeling for who Alexander was as a character, right? Other than the fact that I got that he didn't want to be Klingon, which is fine. I mean, you know, you can reject.
Well, he didn't want to be a warrior.
Yeah,
that's like a specific, you know,
which
warrior.
Which is ironic because he
code.
Thinks cowboys are cool. That's the only other real establishing character trait we got of him in TNG.
Well, with the whole thing about, and that started in the Next Generation, and then we kind of get more of it from TNG. But I thought that another way that they dropped the ball is by saying, "I don't want to be a warrior." They didn't say what that meant, really. It's like, it's kind of like Klingons are warriors, and now I don't want to be a warrior. They didn't explore what it would mean to be like, I want to be a chef, I want to be an artist, I want to be a scientist, or whatever. And so it never really fleshed out his character. It's just like, I don't
want
to do
like
this
thing.
Right, like
he's just there to be contrary to what Worf wants.
Right.
It's he's like, a speed bump as a character for him.
Right, which you talked about before, as that's a thing that happens with child characters, right? As they get thrown in there.
A lot.
Just
yes.
Just to make their parents' lives more difficult, which is basically Alexander in a nutshell. And it, which is too bad because they have that one episode which isn't really about Alexander, but it's about Alexander from the future, where he talks about how he became a diplomat. And it's like, well, on the one hand, not every child when they're like however old Alexander is, like I'm going to say 10 or 12, is going to, you know, be demonstrating the early signs of what they'll do as an adult. That was a direction they could have taken Alexander that would at least have given us something. Right.
Especially because we get the jump from Alexander as he appears on, you know, the Enterprise with TNG, and then we get that massive jump to when he shows up on Deep Space Nine, and then we get another jump again to when he's supposed to be a diplomat, and it's like, where's the in-between there? Why do we not get to see any of the why here, any of the growth, any of the what's going on with this character-ness?
Yeah, well, the one where his being a diplomat, we don't actually see him doing that. We just hear from him in the future, which is actually before he showed up as a like as a teenager in Deep Space Nine, that he became a diplomat, and that was why he wasn't able to save Worf. And which is like, I mean, I guess you can excuse this by Alexander being really upset with grief that his father died, but his whole like, I'm going to change the past so Alexander will become a warrior. It's like, well, why don't you change the past so that Worf had a couple of extra bodyguards
or something? Yeah,
exactly.
You know, just like hire some muscle and be like, hey, I want you to follow Worf around. And when someone tries to jump him, you know, you show him the business.
That follows the rule of time travel always has to be convoluted.
Right.
Go to the wrong spot. Well, because I thought when they brought Alexander back on DS9, I was kind of happy because I thought maybe they'll fix it in a way. Like, that's not, a simplification of what I thought or how I approached it. But when they did the whole, you know, where he was the ship's fool type of thing, like, I thought that was just totally going in the wrong direction because they had that episode about, you know, Firstborn. They could have shown him come back and still have issues with him between him and Worf, but kind of give more from Alexander's perspective about wanting to be a civilian diplomat, like not in the defense force or military, or, you know, because we saw the Klingon lawyer in one episode. It could have been like he's wanting to pursue other things, but then they just say, oh, he joined the defense force, and now he's like the bumbling Gomer Pyle or whatever. It's like, I just thought, why are they doing that? And it could have... Again, he just was an extension of Worf to have Worf be like, you know, difficulty and how do I handle this? And, you know, it was bad.
I'm issuing a challenge to the chat room. Come up with a Klingon name equivalent of Gomer Pyle.
Well,
see what happens.
No, I mean, and that's part of, you know, that's part of the problem with Sons and Daughters, right? Which is the episode of DS9 where Alexander comes back. It's kind of like they decided to bring him back, but his character is so absurd and over the top that it's like it's hard to take him seriously, even though he finally does have some defining characteristics. It's just sort of like, what is going
on?
Such
as they are.
Yeah, kind of. Now, if you want to look at a better version of that, which is still, you know, not really a character in her own right, but at least one that is actually useful for developing the adults around her, you want to look at Naomi Wildman. And, you know,
absolutely, yeah.
Because Naomi Wildman doesn't really have much of a character. We know she's precocious and that she wants to do what all the adults around her are doing, which is be in Starfleet, which is,
It's more of an established continuing character than we get with Alexander, though.
That's true. But, you know, because all we really know about Naomi is that she imprints on the adults around her, like, you know, if any child would do if they were surrounded exclusively by people who do this.
Right. And if she had kids around her, maybe she'd be like trying to do what they're doing or learning a wider range of what people do and how to interact with people. But all she's got are adults who are like Starfleet officers and Maquis and a Borg and Neelix. That's what she's got to work with, and we kind of see that in her character.
Yeah, and they mainly use her as a tool to humanize Seven of Nine, which I think was a good choice. I think that she, you know, works well with Seven of Nine, and it's kind of ironic because she is used primarily to sort of develop her parental figures, even though her actual parent is basically absent from the show.
We can say she's not an extension of her parents' story, but she is kind of an extension of just the adults in her life story.
Yeah, and
but
I mean,
she actually serves that purpose well, as opposed to Alexander.
And we get to see, you know, how Seven of Nine you know, interacts with her and how she kind of helps Seven of Nine understand her individuality, which granted a lot of things do that in later season Voyager, but Naomi did it pretty well. And we get to see how terrible Neelix is as a parent, which is, you know, not surprising, but is also
in an episode,
you know,
where he isn't just cradling a puppet the whole time.
Well, yeah, there's that one. But I mean, like, I'm thinking specifically
of the episode
Once Upon a Time, when something, one of the few episodes that actually does have Samantha Wildman in it, something, you know, may have happened to her that like her shuttle has crashed and they don't know if she's okay. And Neelix is just like, we are not going to tell Naomi that anything is wrong. And like maybe you could excuse that for the first like few hours as you try to figure out what's actually happening. But once it becomes clear that something is wrong, it's like, yeah, you're just making it worse. And the fact that they, you know, I mean, like, on the one hand, okay, I wouldn't expect Neelix to be a good parent, but on the other hand, I also wouldn't really expect them to keep leaving Naomi in his care after that happened, right?
But that is a kind of great thing, because it says what Neelix thinks about the intelligence level of Naomi, both as a character, as a kid, and just in general, and how he deals with a problem, just pretending it's not there if it feels like something he could get away with doing. And anyone who's ever worked with a kid, anyone good who's ever worked with a kid will tell you that just straight up lying to a kid and just pretending like nothing is wrong is not the way to approach a problem, both in the sense that it doesn't solve the problem, and it shows that you're not trusting in what the child is capable of understanding and and just thinking that they cannot handle whatever is happening.
Yeah, and it's not like I can't understand where that desire comes from to, if something is bad is happening, just to not tell the child about it, because, you know, you don't know exactly how the child will react and it could be very unpleasant and you don't want to make the child upset. And it's not like, you know, I mean, I feel all those things too on the rare instances when I have to give a child bad news. Granted, it's usually something more along the lines of, you know, we're not going to be able to have McDonald's for lunch, as opposed to your mom is missing on an alien planet. I've never had to break that news. But by the same token, I'm terrible with children. You should not leave your child with me. It will not go well. So you know, that's the real thing with Neelix, is it's like, why are we letting you be the babysitter? Like, I guess maybe there's no one else off duty who could do it. And to be fair, you know, Janeway does eventually put her foot down and is like, Neelix, stop messing around. You gotta father up here, or man up here, or whatever the term is. Parent up.
Adult up.
Yeah, basically.
Well, it's weird that they didn't have an emergency babysitter hologram that they could just activate.
You know, they probably do somewhere with the, you know, the emergency command hologram. They probably also got like an emergency plumbing hologram and an emergency baby hologram, you know, things like that.
They've got a specialized hologram collection. Got to catch them all. But this topic also gets you thinking, though, about how culturally and in pop culture, how we think about children and handling stress and handling bad news, and how we think about them as characters and trusting in their intelligence, but trusting in their ability to understand the gravity of a situation. And I know you haven't seen it yet, but a good example of this actually is My Neighbor Totoro, I think.
It's true.
Which Oren hasn't seen. Yeah.
I'll give you a report on that next week when I see it.
But I've had to use it multiple times as an example, a good example of a time when saying, yeah, a kid cannot fully understand why bad things are happening, but that doesn't mean they can't understand that bad things are happening around them and it can't affect them in a similar way to an adult without them, you know, as characters being miniature adults. It is possible, and it is a very good look at how a lot of the times when an adult is faced with that situation, they will kind of undervalue a child's emotional ability to process what's happening.
Well, then especially because this is supposed to be Star Trek, right? I mean, it's Star Trek. It's supposed to be more advanced, more developed, more enlightened, more all that, you know, evolved or whatever, to the point where, you know, I don't necessarily think that in the Star Trek universe or in that timeline would still be telling their kids about the Easter Bunny and Santa Claus and the Tooth Fairy. I think, you know, I think they would have moved forward to treat them. Obviously, they're not adults. They're not going to have the same, you know, level of cognitive abilities. But they're also, in a way, children are almost like a sponge. You know, like they take what away, and that's where young kids can learn multiple languages. And so if they were to treat children not as just another adult, but treat them more adult-like or more in a more mature way, I think that would have been nice to see, you know, not like the goo goo gaga or you just, you know, play with your toys, but like showing how parents in the Star Trek time would be treating their children more maturely. And so the children would be able to, you know, be more closer to an adult or more mature, more, you know, sentient, more, you know, just ability to see what's going on around them and to accept it and deal with it. And then, you know, because in a way, I was kind of disappointed when the two times or a couple times we saw the schools in Star Trek, we see it first on The Next Generation or, you know, early where Alexander, the really young version of Alexander, is like, you know, bullying the little kids in that school. And then later we see Keiko do it. So he have little kids.
Wait,
going
we see
into
Keiko bullying the little kids?
no, not really. So Keiko is doing her school work, and so, you know, we see the Next Generation Enterprise school in type of setting, and then the Keiko's school. I was kind of disappointed because obviously they're not going to be doing Geordi level stuff, but it's almost like, you know, going back to, you know, ABCs or something, where you would think that they're by giving the kids more like sciencey type stuff or just more a higher level of schooling, that because then you would have, you know, people like Wesley or some other people that are able to advance beyond, you know, just doing basic first grade type stuff. Like if the culture is going to move forward, it would almost to me seem like they would have the schools would, you know, advance the kids a little quicker, but, you know, they're still treating them just as like little kids that can't really process, you know, mental things as well.
You also got to wonder how parenting has evolved at this point in the future, not just the role of parenting, but like, has there been any Dr. Spock kind of equivalencies in parent and child rearing trends since between now and then? You got to wonder. Was there a whole nother generation raised with the idea that you need to have as little physical contact with your child as possible?
I'd like to think that we are over some of those weird fad parenting crazes that have been, you know, popping up here every now and again. I can't say that for sure. I mean, I guess we do. We don't really. The parenting that we see in Star Trek tends to be very sort of mainstream, as it were. Like, it isn't
right.
You know, it's not anything like out there, like, you know, no contact with your children sort of thing.
We don't see a lot of fringe parenting ideals.
Yeah, but it also isn't, for the most part, very, like, I would say very progressive, where you try to, you know, treat your child more, like, more intelligently. There's at least, and granted, we don't see a lot of parenting. Although we do see this more with Naomi Wildman, I guess because she's not actually with her actual parents. And Seven of Nine is something of a maternal figure, but she's also more of a sibling figure to Naomi than she is with anything else, where she tends to interact with Naomi more like an adult. And that works for Naomi. And in my experience, there are certainly kids who that works for, right? Like, I mean, I'm sure we've all been talking with a kid and been surprised to find out how young they were, right? Where it's like, you know, you talk like a 20-year-old, but apparently you're 12. Like, that's weird. But by the same, and like when I was stage managing, I had to deal with a lot of children, and I basically found that with some of them, if you try to talk with them like they're an adult, it just confuses them and they don't know what they're supposed to do. Mm-hmm. But others, if you talk to them, you know, if you dub yourself down, for lack of a better term, and talk to them like they aren't an adult, they get upset and, you know, and frustrated because you're not taking them seriously. And so you have to really modulate your approach. It's almost like children are different and will have different things that you need to do.
What a thought.
That could have been an interesting, I mean, obviously it wouldn't have happened from what we've seen, but it would have almost been interesting if there was a scene or two of Troy doing her job, of course, but kind of like have a parent having an issue and then addressing it, you know, because in a way, in especially in, you know, I guess in the '80s, but sometimes on television you have to, there's going to be different levels of audience awareness and maturity and you know, ability to understand what's going on. So in a way it would almost be an interesting scene to have, you know, a parent on the Enterprise basically doing like the old way or like, you know, not doing a good job at it. And then Troy telling that parent, hey, treat your kid more like an, not more like an adult, but, you know, give them, you know, more than just, you know,
give them a little credit here.
Yeah. And then it would like, it would kind of, you know, tell the audience, hey, you should do that in the real world. But it would kind of show that, you know, they are trying to progress parenting in the future. And so, you know, I was trying to think who would be the best scene for that. And I guess that's where I went to, you know, Troy trying in a counseling session, but then on DS9, I don't know who would be, you know, the best roles characters for that type of scene, but it would
Ezri,
be nice
probably.
To see. Yeah, that's true. Once we got to that point.
No, that would have to be Space Dad himself, Mr. Sisko. Because not
space
only
dad, the dad of space.
He is Space Dad. Not only is he actually a dad in space, but he is also a father figure to most of the other characters, right? Which is why I thought it was funny that there's one episode where like Sisko is giving O'Brien kind of like fatherly advice, and it's like, man, O'Brien is older than you and has more kids than you.
Actually, I just thought that should probably come from Dax, whether it's Jadzia or Ezri, because Dax has said, like, she was a parent. Because I just thought of that scene.
She's been a mother and a father, yeah.
Right, and I thought of that scene. It was early on in DS9 where, you know, Jake would, like, go always hang out with Nog. And there was that point where Sisko was like, oh, well, I can't, you know, let them. I can't win. He's just going to go. And Dax was like, if I was you, I'd go get him, make him eat his dinner type of thing. But the idea was like, in that episode, we kind of got to see Sisko kind of figuring out or dealing with parenting, because Jake was at that age where it's like he said, if I make Jake choose between me and Nog, he would choose Nog. So it's kind of like, you know, and the advice came from Dax, who was a parent multiple times. So there are glimpses of it, but we definitely, it would have been nice to see more of like parenting issues, because that's a human thing, whether it's, you know, in the Old West or Victorian days or present or in the future, there's always going to be, you know, the parenting issues. And so it would have been nice to see them address it more and then put their Trek's future spin on it.
Yeah, and with Jake, if we're going to mention him, he is kind of
a
very nice middle ground between someone who is sort of an extension of his parent character and a character in his own right, especially later in the show. But like early on in the show, Jake's primary purpose is to make Sisko wonder if he's being a good parent, right? And it's not
right.
It's not as blatant as Alexander, where it's just Worf is a bad parent. Like, that's very obvious. It's really more, you know, we see a more naturally developed relationship where Sisko is like, well, you know, Sisko is doing the best he can, but like any parent, you don't know how your child's going to work out, right? Like, children are people and they change and grow according to their own, you know, what happens to them and what they choose. It's not like, you know, like an algorithm where you can plug in these values and then predict an outcome. So parents, I think that's probably one, even as someone who is not a parent at all, I will still talk about parenting like I know what I'm talking about, which is that, you know, parenting is like virtual uncertainty. Because you do your best and you're like, this is what I think is the best way to help my child grow, but I don't know. I mean, like, what if what I'm doing is actually bad? And you see that happening with Sisko all the time, right? Is he's like, you know, should I let Jake go and hang out with this, you know, with this Ferengi kid? And, you know, he does even
question. The kid is kind of the station's juvenile delinquent.
Yeah. And of course, this is only sort of related to Jake, but it leads to Sisko questioning his prejudice against Ferengi I think it's The Search is the episode.
Right. We also get to see Jake as a character act as a pretty cool link culturally. Like, he's a representative kind of how the standard everyman member of the Federation is starting to feel towards the Ferengi and towards the Bajorans. He serves a representative purpose beyond just showing how things are going with Sisko. He kind of shows how things are going on the station.
That's why I liked how, early on, we see that Jake didn't want to go follow in his father's footsteps and like be like, I can't wait to get into Starfleet. And I thought it was interesting and a good writing ploy or whatever when it was Nog that wanted to, you know, be all gung-ho about, I want to be in this academy and not Jake. But the thing about Jake early on that I just thought was, aside from the parenting, like figuring out parenting, especially with a young kid or a teenager, was in this particular case, it was a single parent, Sisko, a single father, where in the 90s when DS9 was coming out, I remember there was still talk about, you know, on like Good Morning America type talk shows or, you know, other shows about the whole thing about being a single parent and if that's doable and healthy, or versus is that, you know, you're just going to have a troubled, you know, a bad child, or it's a bad thing altogether. So for them to do a single parent at that time was kind of, you know, not groundbreaking, but it was topical, and it was interesting to see them, how they played that out. And, you know, cause you could have had, you know, if Jennifer was still around, they could have both been like, you know, talking the mother and the father, like, so debating both sides of it. Like, should we let him have freedom? Should we be more strict? I mean, they could have done that type of like figuring out parenting, but in his case, he was doing it on his own. So he had to rely on, you know, Dax and other people, and then just, you know, make his own way with it. But there's a lot to Jake that I'm glad that we got to see him for so long, because we saw him as a, you know, young teenager and then grow up and then, you know, become an adult. And so it was good. We got to see him, you know, be, like you said, almost not the audience perspective, but the everyday person's perspective.
Right. He's the everyman of the
non-Starfleet
station.
Right.
Well, and Jake not wanting to join Starfleet is a really pivotal moment for his character, and it really is part of one of the places where he diverges, because up until that point it had sort of been treated like being in Starfleet was just the natural end of every human's career.
It's
like,
what you do. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like being in Starfleet is so awesome, why would you ever want to do anything else, unless you're like Captain Picard's Luddite brother, at where your entire personality is your rejection of Starfleet.
Oh, the space French, what are you gonna do?
Yeah, specifically the non-space French, as it were. But then with Jake, we see that, you know, he's one of the first people we see who chooses not to be in Starfleet as like a legitimate choice. That's actually something that he wants to do, and he has, maybe, you know, he can be fulfilled in other ways. And of course, we see more as the show goes on, right? When we get Sisko's dad, who is a cook, and, you know, we get other characters. But that really helps set Jake apart and helps him towards when he becomes a better character towards the end of the show, when he is, you know, more of a journalist and a writer and a little bit less of a lazy stay about.
That really says something about what you think about writers, doesn't it?
Look, I'm just saying, in some episodes, Jake is like a really strong argument for why the Federation would never work. Cause, you know,
Jake is just a young guy. We got to give him some leeway there. He's still figuring out what he's doing and all that.
Sure, but there are plenty of episodes where we see Jake not really interested in doing anything other than sitting around. It's sort of his, you know, and it's kind of like, well, if that was widespread, then the Federation's whole model would fall apart, because like they're all based on this idea of self improvement, and it's sort of like their philosophy and almost a religion to a certain extent. And like, if they don't follow it, they don't have any other system of making everything work properly.
Well, maybe I'm adding into it myself. Like, obviously, I don't think this was addressed, but to me, I think that's partly because the station, DS9, was supposed to be like far removed, you know, like the front, on the edge of the frontier. And like, that's why in early episodes, Bashir was like, you know, frontier medicine. Because if Jake was at, you know, on Earth, he could, you know, beam to Starfleet Academy, or not the Starfleet, but like, you know, universities, or go to other places around, you know, if he wanted to do the Daystrom Institute, or go to ocean research, or become like, you know, the big arts and entertainment cultural centers. Whereas in a way he's like trapped on the station, and there's not a whole lot for him to do. That's kind of why in the early episodes what they the whole thing with Nog was like there wasn't that many people his age to be friends with. A lot of the station had aliens coming and going. There wasn't a whole lot for him to really pursue, other than it would have to be like nowadays where people do online schooling or something. Like, he didn't have a whole lot of avenues or of opportunities other than just online, basically, because he was trapped, not trapped so much, but he was stuck on the station.
Now, another character on Deep Space Nine who is also sort of fits into the same category as Jake is the character of Zial, because
yes,
she is both
absolutely
her own character, but also very important for her two parental figures, both her actual father, who is Gul Dukat, and her maternal figure, who is Kira. Like,
right.
She develops, she becomes her own person, right? She goes from having a almost fanatical worship of her father to the point where she's like, she will die if her father doesn't want to be with her, to the point where she's realized that her father is actually kind of not a good person and is actively rebelling against his authority. And not just by staying up late and listening to loud music, but by, planting bombs and sabotaging the station. And that's something that that's a character arc that is very, that is a very steep character arc, right? And granted, she goes through several actress changes, which might help, but but it's still, you don't see that kind of character growth very often, even in Deep Space Nine. But at the same time, it's like, Zial makes Dukat a person. Like, without Zial, Dukat is just kind of a monster. But then, when Zial is around, you see that there's a little bit more to Dukat than Hitler. Like, Dukat has other things
Space
going on.
Space Hitler.
Space Hitler, to a certain extent.
Space Hitler digs the Bajorans. Good to know.
Well, he does. That's another weird, creepy factor about Dukat that we could say for another day. But there's, Zial gives Dukat another dimension to him. Right, it's very nice when you have a villain who has things on his mind other than thwarting the heroes. Like, and granted, Dukat does that a lot, right? A lot of his actions are designed to thwart the heroes, where he's like, "I'm gonna conquer the guy." At first he's just like, "I'm just gonna be there to mess with you," and then eventually it gets to the point where I'm going to conquer the Alpha Quadrant. But you have you have Zial around, and she's just making him more interesting because he actually, he has something else that occupies some of his thought process.
Right. And it's kind of similar with her relationship with Kira also, because she's one of the driving forces in Kira's life that kind of forces her to remember, yeah, the Cardassian Bajoran war is over. We kind of have to make peace with these people now. And again, kind of like Molly, she acts to a degree as an extension of Kira and Dukat's relationship, I think, to a certain level. Would you say that?
So yeah, I guess. Although I think with Kira and Zial, it isn't so much that Zial changes Kira as a person, because it's not, Kira was never terribly prejudiced against, Bajoran Cardassian pairings, as it were. She was prejudiced against Cardassians, but she'd gotten over that blind hatred by the time she met Zial. The thing that Zial did for Kira was basically give her an excuse to, or excuse me, an in-character excuse, not an, from a writing perspective, to hang out with Dukat and not just spend every minute wanting to kill him. Because really, she has perfectly good reasons to want to kill Dukat, but she, has to put some of those aside, sort of for the sake of Zial, right? It's like, she...
Right.
Has to not just hate Picard, hate Dukat with every fashion, with every fiber of her being, because she has this child / teenager / young woman, depending on what actress you see her in, who really looks up to both of them, and it would be very damaging for Zial if the two people that she, that she relies on the most hated each other.
Absolutely, yeah. That's kind of what I was going for there. She's a forced sort of mediator between the two characters that forces them to be civil with each other and kind of makes for character growth with both characters mutually.
And it's also great because when Zial dies, that really drives Dukat over the edge.
Turns him in pure evil, yeah.
Yeah, just sort of into space madness.
Spoiler alert. Oh, sorry.
Fair point.
It's only but in the 90s, so, you know, you had your chance.
But because Zial is such a well-rounded character, her death is actually meaningful. It's not just, hey, let's kill this you know,
let's
this
kill
female.
The kid.
Yeah, it's not like we'll kill the kid or the female character to motivate the male character. Like, when Zial
dies...
She doesn't
feel like she was fridged, yeah.
Yeah, like, you mourn for the loss of a character, not the loss of a set piece, right?
Right, and it's great because her death also has multiple repercussions just then driving her biological father insane. We have that as a point of, oh, damn, all this stuff just got real, and also we have to see Garrick and Kira dealing with it, with the guilt of her death, and she affects multiple figures than just her parental figure, which says something about her roundness as a character, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I actually think it's the same thing with Lol, which is Data's,
right, let's talk,
you know,
Lol.
Daughter, sort of. And she's only in one episode, which is part of the reason why I find the character so impressive, The Offspring. And I think the actress, Haley Todd, has a lot of the credit for that one. But in one episode, she, you know, she develops very quickly and becomes kind of her own character. The authors, I think, made the very smart choice of having her diverge from Data in her ability to use emotions and use contractions, even though Data sometimes uses contractions.
Inconsistently, see, doesn't happen.
You know, nobody paid too much attention to that. But she does become her own person, and, you know, even though she was only in there for one episode, when she
that
dies...
That one episode has power. It gets to you.
It does. Although I do wish that they had pursued charges against Admiral Asshat. Because he was just like... You know, I mean, if you watch the episode, like, at the end, he gets all sad, and he's like, it was just not meant to be, you know, this creature. She was too perfect. It's like, no,
you know,
you
this
killed
meant
her.
To be... Schmutz wouldn't have happened if you hadn't, you know, come barging in here, dude.
Like, she literally died of a panic attack that you induced. And it's just like that, you know, you don't deserve to wear that uniform, sir. And I wanted them to, you know, go after
Good
him.
Good day to you, sir.
And, you know, I know why they didn't, because they can't have that kind of continuity on TNG, but I really wanted them to.
Right, but we do get to see Lol and how she interacts with more than just her parental figure. We get to see her issue interacting with children because she's still developing her whole intelligence thing and having a level of being ostracized from them because they know she's different and it creeps them out. We get to see her try and have a job of her own. We get to see her try, albeit very weirdly, to pursue romance or something.
You know, the many phases of complete human life, right? You get bullying, you get awkward romance. I mean, it's just the complete
We get that
package.
Time when you worked as a barback.
You know how it is.
Yeah, although, like you do. That is one the time you make out with Riker.
Well, maybe you,
Part
you've been
of the human experience on Star Trek.
You've been having more fun with Star Trek than I have. One thing that struck me as a bit odd was, so the children are, like, you know, sort of afraid of her. But it occurs to me that it's very common for children to sort of react negatively to another child who looks different, right? Someone who has, like, you know, if you ever get kids who hit an early growth spurt, right, and they're, like, super tall, even if they're, like, roughly the same age as the other kids around them, sometimes they'll get ostracized for that, or if they just have, or if they have some kind of birth defect or what have you. But with Lol, she looks like an adult, so. I think it would be, I'm not sure how children would react to that exactly, to an adult that has a very simplistic understanding of the world.
Well, I think at the same time, that almost is not giving the kids the credit, because those kids...
Yes, absolutely.
Those kids on that ship, they know about Data, like they know Data, they've accustomed to an android, so if you just, you know, it would be different if... Possibly, if it was like an alien ambassador or an alien race, or for whatever reason, it's like an actual person who looked like an adult but had the child mind. But in this case, I think all you would have to say is like, oh, that's Data's, you know, Data created an android. And then they would be like, oh, okay. I don't think it would have been that much of a stretch or a leap in a way, depending on the kid or their age or whatever, or how much they're told. But maybe those kids don't have that much interaction with Data because, you know, he's command or something. But I don't know. I think some kids could just the idea
right.
that you know, she's an adult with a, yeah.
There's a generalization made with how kids would react with this, but as a storytelling device, this is a case of children serving as the proxy for the concept of society is cruel to things that are different.
It's true, although I would expect at least some kids would be like, you're a robot? That's so cool.
That's so cool, yeah.
Unless robots are passé in the future. Maybe by the 24th century, robots are like, you know, are old news. No one cares about robots anymore.
Maybe they, one of the kids would say, you have to stay outside. We don't serve your kind here. Oh, wait, that's a different thing.
Wrong star.
Dang it.
So, you know, I was thinking of what kids, like, in these Star Trek shows have character arcs that are completely independent from their parents. And, you know, the first one that came to my mind is Mr. Wesley Crusher. His story arc really has nothing to do.
We can't have this topic without talking about Wesley Crusher.
The boy.
You know, he really has, his story arc has nothing to do with his mother. Like, he has one or two episodes where they interact in a meaningful way, but really his development would be exactly the same if his mother was not on the ship.
Well, there's an entire season where she isn't also, so, and it just keeps going without her. Which makes me wonder, why is she just cool with her teenage son living on her own, on his own on a spaceship?
Well, I mean, maybe, I don't know. I was trying to think of a joke, and I couldn't think of one. Maybe
that is the joke right there.
Maybe the age of self-determination is much younger in the Star Trek universe. Like for us, it's 18, but maybe in Star Trek, when you're old enough to save the ship from a space disaster, you're old enough to live on your own.
You're old enough to build your own nanites. You're old enough to drive. You're old enough to drive a spaceship. You're old enough to pick out your own jumpsuits.
Oh, Wesley, those jumpsuits aren't doing anybody any favors. But yeah, so because Wesley has his whole, like, as annoying as it is, he has his uber child arc and his, like, chosen one arc. And then he has the problems he has at the Academy story arc. And none of those really involve Crusher, except in a tangential way, which is interesting.
We get to see Wesley have multiple individual arcs as a character.
I don't know if that's a good thing or not. It was just something that I noticed when I was thinking about, you know, how these characters interact with their parents.
It's good and bad. It's good in the fact that we're seeing the representation of a child character a young adult character as an individual character. But at the same time, Wesley's not the best written character. Sadly.
Gasp.
I know. Shock of shocks. I guess I've got an unpopular opinion here, but
I think part of the disservice to the Wesley character, I mean, obviously there's the Mary Sue thing that they could have, you know, sometimes went too far with or whatever. Like, you know, Data and Geordi can't figure it out, but here comes Wesley to save the day. But aside from all that, Jake, and we'll talk about Nog in a little bit, but Jake had Nog, and I think it would have benefited the Wesley character to have at least one friend or one contemporary peer his age. Now, maybe not like, you know, the warp theory Mozart genius he was supposed to be, but you know, there were supposed to be families on the Enterprise, right? And so it would have been interesting.
And we get a few throwaway characters, yeah.
Right, but if they had, like, you know, as reoccurring as Barclay or something, right? Like, it's there, but not every episode. I mean, even Wesley's not really focused on in every episode, but if there was another person his age, like a boy, another boy, so it's not some, like, boyfriend-girlfriend dynamic that they probably would have had to go through because of the bad writing, but if it was like another guy or another, you know, non-gendered alien or something where Wesley would have had another person his age to deal with, like, those adults or, you know, it could have been maybe something better than just always having Wesley around adults.
I feel like having Wesley be peerless, not just in the sense they didn't really have any friends, but in the sense that there were no, like, other people his own age for him to contrast from and for them to show, yeah, Wesley is different than most of the kids around here. He's smart. And to show us what that means, actually, with a character his age. That did the character a disservice, and I feel like it also did what they were trying to do with the character a disservice in the fact that we just had Wesley stand alone, and that adds to the Mary Sue-ness of it. Just stand alone and be like, yes, this is the best child, smartest child, most good-lookingest child. There are no other childs worth mentioning.
I am like unto a god of gray jumpsuits. Now, since we mentioned Nog, we should probably talk about Nog, because he's probably the
absolutely
most extreme example, or not extreme, but the most notable example of this working very well, where Nog's storyline is also almost completely independent of his father. And Rom's a character, too, which is actually kind of a unique accomplishment, is that, but Rom, it's actually almost the other way around. Like, Rom's story is more or less dependent on Nog's story. Right, like Rom doesn't
either
really...
Nog or Quarks at different times. Yeah,
partly right, because I would say for Rom, he's a unique character that had definite growth over the course of the whole DS9. But Rom's character was heavily dependent in a way at times for Nog, for Quark, for Leda. You know, he wasn't 100% independent standalone, because Nog, it was a lot of like interplay between these characters and their dynamic. Whereas with Nog, he was more independent, and you could like remove Rom from the equation from the episodes, and Nog would still have a full development. And I like how they handled Nog.
Right, because he and we've talked about him before, how he has this complete change, reverse from what he originally started as, in that he starts off as the station delinquent, like he's a petty criminal. He's not even a successful criminal. He's just like, getting in trouble for stealing stuff. And then he decides that he wants to be in Starfleet, and it totally works too. Like when I first saw that, he busts his ass
and becomes, good Starfleet. He's competent, very competent.
Yeah, and in the episode where he decides he wants to be in Starfleet, like I was thinking along the same lines as Sisko. I was like, this has to be a trick, right? This is like a scheme to get money. And because I'm racist, like Sisko is.
And because that's pretty much all we have to expect from him up until that point. Just that he's a kid, he's growing, but he's still from the wrong side of the space station.
And of course, it turns out that he has a genuine wish, and when he describes why he wants to do that, it just, it works. And then, of course, he goes through the whole, the war arc and the loss of his leg, and it's only a paper moon. And his if you think about it, his story arc is kind of the reverse of Jake's, where Jake is a character who's like the son of a Starfleet officer who rejects that and decides he doesn't want to be Starfleet. And then you have Nog, who is like from like the
who
least...
throws himself into it, yeah, because he feels like it's the right thing to do and what would give him purpose.
Yeah, so I think Nog is, granted, part of the reason that works with Nog as well as it does, and Grace, we talked about this a little bit before the podcast, is that Nog is played by an adult.
Right.
He's played by Aaron Eisenberg, who was not a teenager. He's just a shorter fellow and puts on the makeup, and as far as we know, he's a teenager now.
He's a teenage alien, yeah, as far as we know.
Yeah, so that is one of the limitations on having characters that have their own really good story arc separate from their parents is the limit on child actors. Now, I don't think that the problem with Wesley Crusher was Will Wheaton's acting, for the most part. I think Will Wheaton did what they told him to do, and I don't know how he would have handled better material.
Yeah, and I think that's why a lot of people who like saw his performance in Stand By Me and what have you were very disappointed when the Star Trek thing happened, because it's like, oh, damn, we know he can act. We know he can act very well. He's just not really getting to here. Or just being directed crappily. And the whole child actor thing is a big problem. It's a big issue with the sort of hurdle to jump with the child character thing, because it's one thing to have an intelligent child character, but that suffers greatly when you've got... when you don't have someone who's capable of playing them. And there's so many limitations with finding child actors, being able to write interesting stuff that child actor is comfortable doing, that they are able to wrap their head around. That just adds a whole new level of limitation that you do not have usually with adult characters.
Right, because acting is a skill that you have to learn. It's like, if you put just a regular person who has never acted before and you tell them to act like a regular person on camera, they won't. Right. If you watch someone who has never acted before trying to act like a real person, they seem like a robot suddenly on television. So And, you know, then that's just the practical side of why it's difficult to find good child actors, because children, as a rule, are younger than adults and haven't had as much time to learn their craft. So, you know, you have to either be, you can get around that if you're really good at direction, right? Like, some of them work and can
be like, look at the kid in The Shining. He didn't know he was even in a horror movie, but they were able to be like, no, act like this when you see that. And they got a good performance out of him.
Sure. And then, of course, you do get the occasional just really naturally talented, you know, children who are really good at acting. I think, you know, I've actually forgotten her name, but I think the character, the girl in Terry Gilliam's Tidelands is probably the best.
Sarah Polley. No, not Sarah Polley. She was in Baron Munchausen. But yeah, I know who you're talking about.
Yeah, I think she's probably one of the best actresses I've ever seen, let alone child actresses. But so that's, you know, that's a limit on having like mature and separate children as characters, right? Is that not even mature exactly, but having them carry their own storyline, because when you do that, it's kind of a risk, right? Because like if the child actor can't handle it, then suddenly you've got the storyline that doesn't go anywhere.
Right, but every couple of years or so, we get a new actress. We get like a Quivajine Wallace or a Dakota Fanning, where it's a child that can act and is, you know, capable and intelligent enough to handle a role, and people will just lose it and be like, oh my god, it's a kid that can act! What is this? A child understands their film? What's happening here? I just love how that is such a consistent thing that happens. You've seen it happen over multiple generations, like when Jodie Foster started acting, just where people will see a child that can act and does have the capability of that, and people will just lose it out of shock. It's like,
I actually just saw a documentary, a biographical type documentary about Scarlett Johansson, where that was the case, that, you know, she started off at age 9,
yeah,
and in auditions and in movies, people are like, oh wow, she could actually have depth and, you know, emote and, you know, be smart about acting, not just be like a little kid, you know.
But until she was a teenager, it was just all like snotty sister roles and bit parts like that,
right?
She was in one of the Home Alone movies. Lord.
We should all be so lucky to be in the Home Alone series, Grace. You shut your face.
I think she wasn't thinking that until she got her part in Ghost World, though.
And, I mean, this is part of the reason why you tend to see better children characters in animated series, right? Because it's, again, you can have a child voiced by an adult. And actually, one that comes to mind for Star Trek is the character of young Spock from Yesteryear of the Star Trek animated series. And I think, you know, people who listen to the show for a while can tell you that I'm not a big animated series fan. I don't think it was very good.
There's not much to be a fan of.
Yeah, I think that the format was a flawed concept. I think trying to tell Star Trek stories in 22 minutes is a bad idea. But that said, Yesteryear is a good episode. That's the one where Spock goes back in time and meets young Spock and sort of saves his own life, basically, is the paradox of the episode.
All right, and for those of us who haven't seen it, tell us what you think makes young Spock a good character, comparatively speaking.
Right, well, the episode, it's what it's really about, you know, is that it's about young Spock learning to be a Vulcan, basically. And we see him being, you know, bullied by the other Vulcan kids, which is where that scene in the 2009 Abrams movie comes from. Although, of course, being a big blockbuster movie, they turned it up to 11. It wasn't just, you know, because in the episode, it's just some Vulcan kids giving Spock a hard time. In the movie, it's like they're beating him up, and then he beats them up, and it's
no, he starts the beating up there. Spock gets overwhelmed and he is the instigator. Physically.
Yeah, that's true. He instigates the physical violence. So,
instigator is a phrase you have to learn when you teach.
Suffice to say, in the episode, it did not, the bullying did not go that far. Like, they were not being as extreme as they are in the movie, and Spock does not respond with violence. He just gets upset. Now, so the episode is really about Spock teaching himself the value of logic. And even though it's hard, the value of the Vulcan way. And it sort of centers around the death of his pet, which is a really sad scene because he has this giant, you know, kind of bear-like pet that
the Seelat.
Yeah, the Seelat that saves his life, and he runs out into the desert, but because it saves him from a monster. But it is injured.
Aww.
And despite the advanced state of Star Trek medicine, for some reason they can't fix it. So the healer tells him that he can keep his pet alive, but it will be in pain for the rest of its life, or he can, you know, let it go. And, you know, the issues with Starfleet medicine aside, that's a really difficult choice for a child to make, right? I mean, you know, that's...
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, I don't know if I probably couldn't have made that choice when I was a kid. I would have, you know, crumpled into pieces and probably not be doing this podcast today because I'd still be dealing with that. Yeah, I'm not sure I could make that choice now, but it shows, like, young Spock really grappling with this problem and deciding logically that, you know, it makes, even though he wants it to have his pet with him, it's a selfish decision, right? Because he doesn't have the right to inflict that life of pain on his pet, and so he, you know, he says to let him go, and that's, you know, it's a very powerful scene for what is otherwise a fairly low set of stakes, but when you put them in that context, it works very well.
Excellent, yeah. That's a pretty good example also of trusting a young character with a big decision like that and being able to say, yeah, this is the kind of decision we do not usually want to see a child make, but there are kids who have to make that decision, and it kind of discredits them to just say that, oh no, this would be an impossible decision for a kid to make, you know?
Sure. It might be impossible for some kids to make, but I'm sure, you know, other kids, like we were saying at the start of the show, kids are different. Right, there's a wide range of what kids can and can't do, and you know,
like
adults
with adults.
Yeah, adults are different too, but I think the differences are more pronounced among children. Like that's been my observation from a completely anecdotal standpoint is that adults tend to fall within a slightly narrower range than children do.
Yeah, more or less, I'd say so.
So that was, so young Spock is the last one I have on my list as a character whose story is more or less independent of his parents, right? Like Sarek is in the episode, but he doesn't really change or develop in any way.
It's
really
Spock's
more,
story, definitely.
Yeah, it's more about Spock's journey. So Grace, since this was your topic, I figured I would let you if there's any a conclusion you want to draw from all of this.
The conclusion I would like to be able to draw is that we would really open up the range of storytelling that we could do if we put more trust in the concept that you can tell a good story with children, even when you have limited acting capability or limited storytelling ability with them. Like, I think a very good example is Sally Draper on Mad Men, because she adds such a level of depth to a story that would otherwise be about the adults in the 60s, and being able to add like the child's perspective to that opens up a whole nother realm. And I can't stop wondering what Star Trek would be like if we just tried a little harder to open that door up more and see what kind of storytelling we could do with it. And I think we've got some very good examples of what happens when you look to that potential and just give it a try. You get story arcs like Jake and Nog, you get to see Wesley have those complete changeovers as a character and grow. You can get a lot. You can get Naomi Wildman helping an adult character grow. The potential there is so insane, and yet it feels so culturally untapped with a lot of television and with a lot of pop culture in general. And it just, I don't know, on a personal note, it kind of grinds my goat that we just, as a society, don't trust children's intelligence a lot. And I think that this is a very good example of when, as characters, we show that child characters can be interesting, they can be trusted, and they can carry a plot that really adds to a bigger story.
Yeah, I'd agree. I think that it seems like a lot of shows are, you know, they tend to play it safe, right? Like a child
right.
character that is interesting is a risk, and they're like, let's not take the risk. And that
it's
seems to be.
It's just another example with popular media that some risks are worth taking because you play big, you win big, essentially, and you can do some amazing stuff with a good child character, as you can with many other risks, and sometimes the risks are worth taking.
All right, David, you have any closing thoughts on this?
Well, I agree that children should be written for, you know, as children, but written for better, not just, you know, writing another adult character and having that, you know, played or portrayed as a child. But I kind of also think that whether it's you're supposed to be the evolved sensibilities of, you know, future Star Trek, I think it even applies to today, because we have seen, you know, in different cultures around the world and at different times, children were treated differently, a lot of times, you know, treated badly, but depending on the type of society, you know, they would be made to read, you know, more than just little children's books. Like, they would actually be reading Jules Verne or Huck Finn or whatever. But I kind of think that overall, it's kind of like treat the children better, and then they'll be able to be better in the real world. But also that, I think, affects how children are portrayed in media, because a lot of times, like I said before, parents or society or whoever is going to be like, you know, let them be a kid, just, you know, let childhood be a longer, you know, thing. And if you're going to give kids, you know, dumbed down education and treat them that way, then you're going to get back from them what you put into them, in a way. So if we treat children, you know, better, more intelligently, more maturely, that, you know, they'll be able to handle a lot more. But also, that I think would also let people, whether it's the audience, whether it's the writers or directors, producers, be more willing to let children have like heavier roles or more involved storylines and more depth. Because if we're just going to keep kids, you know, playing with little toys and not tell them about the world, tell them about emotional, you know, things, then they're not going to be equipped to handle it, because they weren't given the ability. Or I'm kind of going, it's weird, because I kind of think what we see in entertainment and fiction comes from how we treat children in the real world and what we think of them in the real world. So I think both of them need to be improved, but especially, like, you know, we've seen great child actors and in stories. I think children in stories doesn't have to be children's stories. You know what I mean? If that makes a sense.
Right.
So I would like to see better portrayals of children.
So generally speaking, if you give children room to grow, both in real life and in popular media, you can definitely see growth there if you just let it happen or give it the room to happen.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that's a good note to end the show on. If you guys, unless there's something that you guys think needs to be said.
Nope. If any of our listeners have any feedback, please write to us. Tell us how you feel.
Yeah, and you can do that at allthingstrek@hotmail.com. And next week we will get to Data Logan's email, I promise. But until then, thank you for listening. And this has been All Things Trek, signing off.